You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 17th of September, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. And I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, actually. Yes, it's a gloriously sunny day here where I am, and I'm feeling not quite full of the joys of spring, but full of the joys of Indian summer, I suppose.
Well, you're very lucky there, because it's pretty miserable here. It's raining away, so I really don't mind being indoors recording podcasts when the weather is like that outside. And we've got four stories that we're going to get into today, and of course, really, we have to start off with the Labour Party and the anti-Semitism scandal, which I was really disappointed to see Jeremy Corbyn actually back down last week and accept the Holocaust Remembrance Society's definition of anti-Semitism. And I really did think that the Jews were now going to back off and leave him alone. But it appears that they haven't done so. They are still attacking him, and that just wasn't good enough for him to be doing that. And I hear today you just sent me an article where some Orthodox rabbis are disassociating themselves from all the rest of the Jews that are still attacking him. So what's going on here, Max? Why aren't the Jews happy that he's basically given in and said that they will accept their definition of anti-Semitism? What's up with them?
Well, I think firstly that there's been a letter that's been circulated around Jeremy Corbyn's constituency, which purports to come from a number of Orthodox rabbis, and they are, as you say, disassociating themselves from the attacks that have been made on Jeremy Corbyn, and I think the reason for that is that the Jewish community in Britain isn't a monolithic thing. It is composed of different components, and one of the component parts of the Jewish community are the ultra Orthodox sections of the community, which a certain number of which are actually anti-Zionist. And so what we've seen on certain occasions when there have been either demonstrations by Zionist Jews in favour of Israel, or where there have been demonstrations by nationalists against certain privileges that certain sections of the Jewish community claim, there have on those occasions been small demonstrations or small groups of Jews from the ultra-Orthodox congregations who've been campaigning against Zionism and who've been disassociating themselves from the State of Israel. And I think that they're obviously aware of the fact that Jeremy Corbyn isn't actually a racist, and Jeremy Corbyn isn't anti-Jewish, that Jeremy Corbyn is just critical of the policies that are pursued by the Israeli government, and they agree with him that it's perfectly legitimate for people to criticise the policies of the Labour of the Israeli government, rather, without that criticism being considered to be anti-Semitic. It's quite interesting, though, that the that article was quite amusing because of the fact that other leaders within the Jewish community initially said that the letter had to be a fake. They couldn't believe that anybody who was Jewish would actually ever speak out in favour of Jeremy Corbyn, and yet it's been admitted that yes, these were that this was a genuine letter, and. The other thing that amused me with regard to this story was that it revealed in the final couple of paragraphs of the story, it revealed the fact that there were going to be some significant constituency boundary changes some constituency boundary changes that were going to significantly affect Jeremy Corbyn. And so I sort of looked into this, and I've done a little bit of research on the internet during the course of the day, and it's fairly apparent. I haven't been able yet to identify who the people are behind the constituency boundary changes. Just to say that there has been a commission that has been involved in looking at these changes. And one of the things that they've done, surprise, surprise, is that they've decided that they're going to significantly change Jeremy Corbyn's constituency. And in fact, his constituency, which is Islington North, is actually going to be abolished and replaced by another constituency called Finsbury Park and Stoke Newington. And from the wards that compose his constituency, a number of those wards are going to be dropped from the constituency and are going to be ceded to other constituencies surrounding it. And they tend to be wards that have got a very small Jewish population, surprisingly. And it was just interesting to me that the five wards that have been added, is it five wards? Yes, the five wards that have been added have, on average, got a much higher Jewish population. One of them, the Stamford Hill West constituency, has got a very, very large Jewish community, which constitutes 37.6% of the population of that ward. And so what's happened here is that I think it's fairly, for it to be just sheer coincidence that at a time when Jeremy Corbyn is being attacked for being anti-Semitic, and Jewish groups are trying to apply pressure to him and apply pressure to the Labour Party, that there is a boundary change, which means there's a switch away from the very low level of Jewish population within Jeremy Corbyn's constituency to the abolition of his constituency, and the main constituent part being added to by further wards that have just got a significantly higher Jewish population. So that what that will then mean for Jeremy Corbyn in the future, and certainly for the next general election, if these constituency changes come in before the next general election, that Jeremy Corbyn will Jews will have a far greater say in whether Jeremy Corbyn gets elected. So first of all, his constituency is disrupted by virtue of the fact that three of the wards that compose the constituency are being transferred to different constituencies, and then the balance of the Jewish population in his constituency is being massively increased by the addition of these five other wards that are in parts of London with higher Jewish populations. And so I think that's quite a significant thing, and it couldn't possibly, in my view, just be coincidence that that's happened. Coincidences like that just don't happen. And it must be a great shame. And I keep sort of reiterating this point that I don't raise this issue on a regular basis with you when we do these podcasts. I don't raise this issue because I'm trying to promote Jeremy Corbyn as being a great guy. What I'm actually raising this issue for is to demonstrate to people within the Labour Party the fact that that proportion of the Jewish community that are fanatically Zionist and fanatically obsessed with promoting the cause of Israel and quelling any criticism of the government of Israel, that proportion of the Jewish community in this country is actually throwing a spanner in the works of Labour. Because when you look at Jeremy Corbyn's, when you look at his history, he's not some person who's just by accident been cast into a position where he's the leader of the Labour Party. If you look back at what he's done as a backbencher and as a constituency MP, he's actually he's got a track record which in any other situation where there wasn't this clash between him and certain sections of the Jewish community over his views with regard to Israel, if it wasn't for that, Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party would be absolutely riding high in the polls. They would have a sort of a 20-point lead over Theresa May, because Theresa May, and she has been shown to be a complete bumbling idiot when it comes to negotiating our exit from the European Union. She is pursuing an agenda of her own, which doesn't really serve the wishes of the British electorate as they were expressed in the referendum on the European Union. And so when you could look at what Jeremy Corbyn's achieved, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn became the elected MP for Islington North in 1983. And this was a constituency that was created in 1885. So almost 100 years previously, this constituency was created, and the constituency virtually never changed. It didn't change pretty much all the way through until he got to around about 1975. And then there were some changes in the constituency. But Jeremy Corbyn got elected in 1983, and his majority, his proportion of the electorate in that election was only 14,951, which was 40.4% of the the constituency. Actually, I'm not quite sure now that was the number of votes he got. I think that's actually his majority. Yes, that's right. His majority was 14,951, and he received 40.4% of the vote. In the following general election in 1987, his share of the vote had gone up from 14,000 up to 19,577, which was 50%. In the next election, it went up to 21,742, which is 57% of the electorate. In 1997, it went up to 24,000, which was 69.3% of the electorate. Then there were some boundary changes, which knocked him back, and so he went back to 18,000. His majority had been cut. But then it went from 18,000 to 16,000, but then to 24,000, to 29,000, and then to 40,000. So it's got a majority of 40,000, and 73% of the electorate voted for him in that constituency. So he obviously is, despite all the fact that he is an extreme left-wing candidate and everything else, and despite the fact that we disapprove heartily of his politics, he is an extremely popular man in his own constituency, far more so than a lot of other politicians. So, you know, that would be the sort of thing that other people within the Labour Party would point to and say, oh, look at that, Jeremy Corbyn, he's a great guy, you know, we need him as the Prime Minister, look how well he's served his constituency. But no, they're ignoring that, and everything is focused on his opinion of Israel, because the people that are attacking him are allowing their prejudice in favour of Israel to outweigh everything else that he does, and to outweigh everything else that he says, to outweigh everything else that the Labour Party says. And it's just obsessing the news as it was. And what we've got here then is a situation also, I mean, the other aspect, I nearly missed this out now, the other aspect of Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party leadership is that if you look at the membership of the Labour Party, at the end of the Second World War was absolutely sky high. There was just under a million members of the Labour Party then. But then in the post-war years, the percentage, the number of people that were members of the Labour Party diminished, so that by 1980, there were only 600,000 members of the Labour Party. And I say only because that's actually quite considerably larger than the number of people who are members of the Conservative Party now. But then it fell, and it fell in the early 80s down to just over 200,000, the membership, and then it bobbled along at 200,000. It went up a little bit to about 300,000, just around about the turn of the millennium. But then during the Blair and the Brown years, it just fell and fell and fell to less than 200,000 people. Jeremy Corbyn becomes the Labour leader, and the membership of the Labour Party triples. So it's gone back up to almost 600,000 members now. So again, in any other situation, people within the Labour Party, MPs within the Labour Party, would be saying, oh, look at that, you know, our membership has trebled under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. What a great guy he is. You know, he ought to be Prime Minister, blah, 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 blah. But no, all the parliamentary Labour Party, all the MPs, well, not all of them, but a very large proportion of them, have just, ever since he was elected leader of the Labour Party, they've just consistently campaigned just to undermine his leadership and to try and get him out. And so again, what we see is all these Labour MPs in Parliament who are allowing themselves to obsess over, or who perhaps are being induced to obsess about Jeremy Corbyn's views on Israel, and allowing that to outweigh everything else good that Jeremy Corbyn's done as Labour leader. And so here we are in a situation now where, as far as his constituency of Islington North is concerned, the wards of Junction Ward and St George's Ward and Mildmay Ward are being ceded to other other constituencies, and then he's having Brownswood, Cliswold, Stoke Newington, Woodbury Down and Stamford Hill added, that have got these larger Jewish populations. And it, to me, it just smacks that, you know, there's been some kind of conspiracy amongst the people that are involved in the boundary, constituency boundary changes, in order to bring that change around. Because, you know, why else would they want to do that? And if they wanted to change his constituency boundaries, why change them in such a way that he has a larger, much larger Jewish component within that constituency population? You know, all this sort of thing is just too much to be just coincidence. And one of the things that I'll be looking into in the next few days is the composition of the people who have who make up the Boundary Commission, because it will be interesting to see, you know, just who they are and what their position is and what their position has been, to sort of identify whether or not there has, in fact, you know, I'm saying it's too much to be coincidence. It seems too much to be coincidence at the moment, and it remains to be seen whether we can prove that it is more than coincidence.
Yeah, it looks like sabotage. It looks quite clearly like sabotage. I mean, there's no other way that you can look at it. I mean, he's got, what, 1% Jews in his constituency at the moment, and he's got 70% of the vote, and suddenly they're quadrupling that. So he's got 4, 5, 6% Jews in his constituency. Just, you know, there's no other word that you can call it other than sabotage, really, is there?
Well, I think it's for any Labour MPs that are on this Boundary Commission, any Labour MPs, they ought to have fought tooth and nail to preserve the constituency of the Labour leader, because what they, you would think that the one thing that they would want to have happen at the next general election is for Jeremy Corbyn to be re-elected. So they would fight tooth and nail. They would sort of die in a ditch to make sure that Jeremy Corbyn's 40,000 majority is preserved, to ensure and to virtually guarantee that he'll get re-elected at the next general election. But no, it appears that the Labour Party people who are on that Boundary Commission have been feeble and have allowed other people to first of all just dismantle his constituency, and to sort of add in a population that are likely to be hostile to him. I mean, we don't know whether, because I think a lot of the Stamford Hill Jewish community are actually the ultra orthodox ones, and so they actually may be quite well disposed towards Jeremy Corbyn. But it just seems unlikely that would necessarily be the case, or it's unlikely that people who are the enemies of Jeremy Corbyn would actually want to make these changes if that was the case. But anyway, I think this is an issue which is interesting. It highlights a further aspect to this ongoing anti-Semitism row within the Labour Party, and it'll be interesting to see how it all pans out.
Yeah, I look forward to hearing just what the racial makeup is of the people behind the boundary changes, because that's quite clearly a stab in the back. And, you know, you're quite right. They really should be trumpeting all these achievements, all these great achievements that he's made, not attacking him. Especially not when he's actually given in to them and said, yeah, well, we'll go along with your definition then. And that's not enough for them. I believe Margaret Hodge said that's not enough. There's nothing that he can actually do to stop us from attacking him, basically.
Well, that's right. After the the Labour Party had agreed to accept the International Holocaust Remembrance Association's definition of anti-Semitism. I'm not sure that it was Margaret Hodge, but I think it was Margaret Hodge, turned around and said that it was too late, that, you know, there was nothing he could do, words to the effect that there was nothing he could do to redeem himself now in the eyes of Britain's Jews, and which, when you consider that she's a Labour MP and he's the leader of the Labour Party, you know, what on earth is she thinking, saying things like that?
They want to sacrifice him to Moloch. That's what they want to do. They want to sacrifice him to Moloch, and they want to put him through the fires. Nothing less than that will appease these Jews. Anyway, let's get on to some of these other stories that we've got for listeners this week. This one comes in from South Yorkshire. South Yorkshire police have been blasted over a statement encouraging people to report offensive or insulting remarks. Not hate crimes, but just offensive or insulting remarks. The police force used Twitter to urge citizens to put a stop to hate by reporting what it called non-crime hate incidents. The force acknowledged that police can only prosecute when the law is broken, but said that non-crime hate incidents, like an insulting comment, can feel like a crime to those affected. Critics, of course, pointed out that recorded crime in the South Yorkshire area has actually risen by 30%, compared with a national rise of 21%, and that the force should be focusing on real crime. Twitter users also said the suggestions impinge upon free speech and would usher in an Orwellian society in which people will be reported for thought crimes. One online commenter called it a bridge towards totalitarianism, while another added, you could probably just lock a good 25% of the public away now and call it crime prevention. The suggestion was ridiculed further with one person tweeting, just to be clear, you want me to phone the police when there hasn't actually been a crime, but someone's feelings have been hurt. And that's exactly it. That's all this is. They are now having this big drive to get people to report on other people who have hurt their feelings. And that seems to them to be more important to them than violent crimes that are actually going on. You know, only 5% of crimes in this country are now actually solved. 95% of them are not going solved. And we've got the police saying that they want to have their time taken up with when people's feelings are hurt, when there's no actual chance of it ever being a crime or being prosecuted for a crime, they just want to hear about it. You know, this, you would think that they would be looking at this hate crime and the impinges on free speech and saying, well, is it really that important? Surely we need to be diverting resources to genuine violent crimes that are going on, but they're not. They want to be diverting resources to something that isn't even a crime. Surely there must be some people on the police force that are actually questioning this. But even up in Scotland, they're actually having they've had an inquiry into hate crimes, and not is this working? Is this reasonable to actually be doing this? But looking at ways that they can prosecute people all the more, looking at aggravating factors. And over here in England as well this year, they've having the same investigation looking at aggravating factors for things that people say online. One of the aggravating factors could be that you have a popular YouTube channel. If you have lots of followers and a video that you've made has reached lots of people, that could be an aggravating factor. If you have lots of followers on Facebook, that could be an aggravating factor. And if something is an aggravating factor, then it has an increased prison sentence. So what this is doing, I think, is this is a precursor to tightening up this hate crime legislation and saying if you feel as if you've been insulted and you're an ethnic minority, then that will eventually be classed as a crime. I mean, why else would they be doing this? Do you think, Max?
Well, they've already established this rule. I think it was from the McPherson Committee. Report that if somebody believes that a hate crime has been committed, then a hate crime has been committed as far as the police are concerned, you know. And so this is just a further extension of this same sort of line of logic that all needs to happen is for somebody who is a member of an ethnic minority or any other kind of protected minority, they just have to feel that they might have been slighted in some way or discriminated against some way, and then that really does constitute, you know, that they believe it does constitute a real crime. One of the things that I chuckled about, I think it was yesterday as I was reading the news, and I can't remember what actual branch of the police force it was, but there was a situation where a serving police officer was making a presentation to another group of police officers with regard to, and I think it was something to do with corruption associated with the public's perception of the police. And this police officer used, during the course of his presentation, on several at several points during the presentation, he used the term whiter than white. He kept saying the police have to be seen by the public to be whiter than white. The police have to be whiter than white. And apparently one of his colleagues has reported him for making the non-white members of the audience feel bad, basically. And so he's now been suspended on full pay pending a disciplinary thing, you know, which it's just ludicrous, isn't it, that a police officer. And when you consider the extent that the police go to nowadays, you know, they bend over backwards, they almost, you know, genuflecting and prostrating themselves in front of all of the ethnic minority groups in order to appear to be as nice as they possibly can and inoffensive as they possibly can. They're sort of going down into all of these multicultural events, and they're twerking and groin grinding with the best of them and doing all their dad dancing, and still people are still finding phrases like whiter than white to pillory them with, which is just, you know, utterly ridiculous. And as you say, yeah, you know, when is somebody senior in the police, when are they going to grow a pair and just say, look, this is just ridiculous. It's destroying the morale of the police officers. Because I don't know whether you ever get an opportunity to speak to off-duty police officers, and I do from time to time. And one of the things I can tell you is that the morale within the police all across the country is absolutely at rock bottom. Most serving police officers are pretty much aghast at what they see going on. You know, when they see all this video of these officers humiliating themselves at the Notting Hill Carnival and stuff of that sort, it just makes them, that they just can't stand it. And these police officers are sort of people who would be the backbone of the police service in the past, and they just can't wait to retire. They're just looking, watching their pensions mount and longing for the day when they're going to be able to just give their notice and retire from the police force. And it's so sad. And they're being replaced by spotty, skinny, anemic sociology graduates who then are just hopeless when it comes to actually enforcing law and order, and who then indulge even further in all of these sort of stupid antics a sort of minority events, etc. And it's just sort of a, not really a vicious cycle, but just a sort of a ridiculous cycle that's going from bad to worse as time goes on. And you know, as we just sort of surmised, sooner or later somebody is gonna have to just say, look, this is ridiculous, we've got to stop doing this, because there's no point having a police force if we carry on like this.
Well, all they seem to be saying at the moment is saying, well we want more money. They had Cressida Dick, she's tiny, she's only about 5 foot tall, is lesbian, she's in charge of the Metropolitan Police, and she gave a 2-hour speech, I think it was, the other day, and the upshot of it was, we want more money, we're not getting enough money. But the thing is, if they were to actually divert the money that's gone towards hurt feelings, the thousands of police officers that are there to investigate hurt feeling crimes, if they were to actually direct that towards real crimes, they'd have a lot more money. And yet none of them are saying that. They all seem to appear to believe that this is so important that we investigate hate crimes. And when you were saying there that it's these spotty sociology graduates that the police are taking on now, they're actually taking on black criminals. There's been a directive that they need to get more black and minority ethnics into the police force. But the problem is, most black and minority ethnics have all got a criminal record. So what they're saying is that even if you've got a criminal record now, you can become a member of the police if you're black, basically. So we will end up with black criminals in the police force. We'll also end up with black criminals as magistrates and judges. They've said the same thing. about that. They seem to believe that if Negroes are in the dock and they see that it's a black judge there, for some reason, for some strange reason, that means that less Negroes are going to commit crime. It doesn't actually make any sense, but of course this was all thought up by David Lammy, who isn't particularly known for his logical faculties. There have been some others that have been critical of this. Journalist Toby Young was critical of the advice, saying if the incident in question isn't a crime, even under the absurdly capricious legal definition of a hate crime, then what is South Yorkshire Police proposing to do by way of not tolerating it? If a comment is offensive but not a crime, it's quite clearly not a police matter. And the tweet comes soon after Justice Minister Lucy Fraser announced a Law Commission review into hate crimes. In Scotland, a review is already in progress following a report by Lord Bracadale QC, who made his recommendations to the Scottish Government. And this is the disturbing thing, because this commission, as I said, this commission in Scotland, well, this review in Scotland has just said that they need to be adding aggravating factors to it and going after more people because there's more of these crimes are occurring. But as you said earlier there, Max, what it boils down to is if somebody feels that a hate crime has been committed, then a hate crime has been committed and you are a victim. And what that is basically doing is saying that the so-called victim is also the judge in this case. It's up to the victim to be their own judge of whether something has been a hate crime or not, which goes against, you know, the very foundation of our legal system itself, which is that you cannot judge in your own case. This is the reason why we have courts. This is why you have witnesses, why you have judges, why you have juries, because to decide whether something is a crime or not has to be decided by somebody who is not the victim. Because the victim is obviously going to be biased. And yet somehow all of that precedent, if every precedent that we've ever had in law up until this time has been turned on its head to say that the victims of so-called hate crimes can also be the judge of whether it's a hate crime or not. And of course, it only ever applies to ethnic minorities or sexual minorities. It doesn't apply to the average white man. So it just means that they've got extra privileges. And they shouldn't have extra privileges. If anybody in the country should have extra privileges, it should be the nation that built the country, the people whose homeland it is. If you were in China, you would expect the Chinese, if someone was attacking the Chinese, you would expect the Chinese to take a very dim view of it and to throw the book at the person that was attacking them. But in white countries, it's the opposite way around. If somebody speaks nastily to somebody that is white, nothing gets done about it at all. If somebody attacks somebody that's white, that's not considered a hate crime. There's no aggravated penalty for that. But if somebody who is white, say, robs somebody who is black, then that Negro could just say, well, it was motivated by hate, and there'd be an increase in the penalty. See, we have a two-tier law system, and it's just getting worse. And each time they do these investigations, there doesn't appear to be anybody that's speaking up and saying, well, what a nonsense this is. I know that the review that they're actually having in England, Mark Cullett highlighted this, and because they wanted public participation. And I do think that there, a lot of nationalists actually filled the form out and put their own thoughts on there. And the results of that, I believe, will be coming out near the end of this year. So it will be interesting to see whether they actually paid any attention to the public participation, because I do think that most of it will have actually been on our side. I guess the representatives of the black and minority ethnic communities, I guess they will have been involved, but not many just black citizens. I don't think they would have taken any interest in it, but certainly lots of nationalists have done. In 2013, the government agreed to reform the law to give more protection to free speech. Well, that's the first time I've heard of that. Following a lengthy campaign spearheaded by the Christian Institute and the National Secular Society, the Reform Section 5 campaign wanted the word insulting removed from Section 5 of the Public Order Act. Celebrities including Rowan Atkinson and Stephen Fry backed the campaign, and after the government relented, the change was incorporated in Section 57 of the Crime and Courts Act 2013. In 2014, the Institute helped lead another free speech campaign, Reform Clause 1. The Anti-Social Behaviour Crime and Policing Bill sought to outlaw nuisance and annoyance. And I think that is still there. But So they've moved the word insulting from Section 5 of the Public Order Act, and yet now we've got this police force that are seeking to bring that back in, saying that if you are feeling insulted, then please phone the police and tell them about it, even though it isn't a crime. And we're being told not to bother the police with things like burglaries, things like muggings, because they're not going to investigate them, so don't bother telling them. And yet, on the other hand, we're being told that we should be phoning up and telling them if we just feel insulted, even if it's not a crime. It's absolutely insane.
Yeah, it's a sad situation that we find ourselves in now, where the police are always talking about the shortage of money, and they're talking about the shortage of money, firstly, because I believe that in real terms, the budgets that they have to operate on have actually been decreasing. Numerically, the budgets have been going up, but they've not been going up by as much as inflation, and so therefore, the budgets have actually been decreasing. And so what we have is our police chiefs trying to do trying to manage with effectively less money and also an ever increasing component within their within the scope of work that they're involved in, which is related to hate crimes and this sort of thing. And so as far as real crime and real policing is concerned, there's less and less money available for that. They have to cut back on the number of officers that they have. That there've been a number of occasions when they've had to reduce the number of serving police officers, and so there are less police officers that are being paid numerically more money, which is probably not worth more money because it hasn't kept up with inflation, and who are trying to do the same amount of work, if not more, than their colleagues, a much larger number of them, have been able to do in the past, but who are hampered by the fact that so much police money is being diverted into these minority causes. And of course, every time there's a police officer that claims that they've been discriminated against, and these sort of turn up with monotonous regularity, police officers from the ethnic minorities who turn around and accuse their employers of discriminating against them, when in reality all that's happened is that they've been passed over by somebody for somebody better into the promotion stakes. And of course, when these people win their cases, or in fact whether they win them or not, as far as the police force is concerned, they're having to pour money down the drain with legal fees. And if they don't win the case, then not only have they had to spend loads of money on legal fees that they're never going to get back, but they've also then got to pay compensation and pay the legal fees of the person who has brought the action against them. And so an ever-increasing proportion of the police budget is going in compensation claims and in fighting against compensation claims. And so it's all very sad. And it will have to end at some point, because what will eventually happen is that our police forces, over a period of time, will be transformed from the predominantly capable people that there are at the moment to people who are incompetent, because as the police attempt to pay less and less, then they will have lower quality recruits. I mean, irrespective of whether they bend the rules in order to increase the numbers of ethnic minority candidates that are accepted into the police force, the quality of police officers will diminish, just purely by virtue of the fact that the smarter people, who otherwise perhaps in the past might have become police officers, that they will deduce, you know, pretty quickly that they're on a hiding to nothing if they try to forge a career within the police, unless of course they happen to be the sort of people who revel in political correctness, and so those people will be forging careers elsewhere, and so we'll have a police force that will be perpetually more and more underfunded, or underfunded certainly in terms of the areas where they're actually fighting real crime, and larger and larger amounts of money will be wasted on minority causes, and the police force will eventually become completely ineffective. And once it becomes completely ineffective, then what you'll have is members of the public deciding to take the law into their own hands. And the number of times that you, in conversations in a pub, you'll just overhear somebody talking about something outrageous that's happened in the news, and they'll say just some sort of off-the-cuff remark, you know, oh, if that happened to me, I'd just go around there and, you know, whatever. And so these things do occur to people, and people are becoming increasingly aware of the fact that if they get burgled, that it's only in a very small minority of cases, only if the burglar indulges in sort of grotesque violence against them and their family while they're subject to the burglary's presence. Only then will the police get involved. You know, if it's just a clean break-in, some money taken, or you know, some objects taken, the police will just assign you a crime number, and that will be that. You won't see them in a large number of cases, unless of course you happen to be somebody who's very important as well. You know, if you turn out to be a lord, or if you turn out to be a member of parliament or something of that sort, then of course the police will trot along and dutifully doff their cap and tug their forelock for you. But as far as members of the public are concerned, they won't. And so, as I say, increasingly in the future, what will happen is that people resort to their own measures. And already we're seeing private police forces starting to spring up with wealthier people, the sort of people that live in gated communities, employing private security firms to police the area in which they live. And this sort of thing will continue, and we'll find that there will be a them and an us situation, where those people that are wealthy enough to live in these gated communities and to employ their own police forces will have the kind of civilized protection that, you know, we always came to take for granted in decades gone by. But increasing in the future, what we'll find is that the vast majority of people will be vulnerable to the rates of crime that will exist in a society where there is virtually no deterrent as far as the criminals are concerned.
Well, I think that's where it's going to end up. And I think also what we will have is the normal police force doing their day job, investigating hate crimes, and then they'll be doing private work as the private police force, the same as with the NHS now. We have doctors that are on the NHS that also do private work. So we'll have police that do normal police work, which doesn't really achieve anything. It's just all about political correctness. And then they'll have their evening job where they're looking after the rich people. And we've already got these vigilante groups. We've got the paedophile hunters that go out and entrap the paedophiles, and very good people involved in that. And we've actually got the police now that are talking about working with them and franchising it out to these paedophile hunters. So we're already seeing these groups forming because the police are incapable of doing the job that they're supposed to be doing. And it can only end in corruption and incompetence. If you haven't got good enough people that are doing the job, you're not paying the good enough money for them, and they're deliberately employing low IQ people, and also deliberately employing people that don't actually have the physical presence of police so that they can be politically correct and say that they've got X amount of women, X amount of short-statured people, then the police are just going to lose all respect. There's no other way that it can possibly end. I mean, the law itself doesn't actually have a lot of respect anymore when you've got hate crime laws. And I've got another incident here of where the law really doesn't reserve any respect. I mean, this story itself, it should be so predictable that it shouldn't have actually been allowed to happen. But because we're now so politically correct with all this transgender business, that it means that we're actually putting men into women's prisons that just suddenly decide that they're now actually females. A convicted pedophile and rapist who was transferred to a women's prison after he said he was transgender sexually assaulted multiple women within days of the move. Who could have guessed that would happen? A man who calls himself Karen White pleaded guilty to repeatedly raping a woman in 2016, having previously been convicted of a sex attack on a child in 2001. He has now been accused of exploiting a rule which allows men who say they are women to be remanded into the prison which matches their gender identity at the prison service's discretion. Well, how has he exploited that rule? Because you no longer actually have to have a doctor saying that you have gender dysphoria. Now Theresa May wants people to just be able to say, well, I'm actually a woman now. So you can self-certify yourself as being a different gender, and which is obviously what this guy has done. He said, oh, I'm Karen White now. So how has he exploited it? How has he exploited that rule? He hasn't exploited it. He's done exactly what you would expect perverts to do if they're allowed to get away with doing that. I mean, how could they do this without realizing that he was going to abuse women?
Yeah, I mean, there was a ridiculous case that I saw a little while back, and it was brought to my attention again just a couple of days ago, of a young guy who, I think he lived somewhere in America, who became a transsexual, and but then entered the female teenage wrestling competitions that were being held. And I think he's become he won some sort of major championship. So he's now 2 years on the trot, become the women's under, I think something like under 18 or something like that, women's under 18 wrestling champion for his state in America. And it's sort of really annoying the other athletes who are genuinely women, because this chap's obviously got a tremendous advantage, being, you know, he may have had an operation to have his genitalia removed, but the point of fact is that he's still got a masculine physique and still would have benefited. And so from the photographs that I saw of him, he looked just like, you know, any other sort of young teenage lad, to be quite honest. And obviously, therefore, you know, has an unfair advantage. And this is... a similar kind of thing to the situation that exists in international sport, where you have individual athletes who, because they are hermaphrodite, have, if they're women, have particularly high levels of testosterone and therefore are able to dominate races. There have been some instances of that sort of thing happening.
Caster Semenya, she's a hermaphrodite, and she's got lots of testosterone. Obviously looks male, but she runs in the female races. Yet when she got married, she was the groom, dressed in a suit and dressed up as a groom, as a man. Yet when she runs in the races, she's a woman.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous, isn't it? Going back to the police situation, we have a situation now where the police are increasingly looking for measurable crimes that they can adopt a zero tolerance attitude towards. And so, of course, although they may declare they've got a zero tolerance attitude towards other types of crime, when it comes to things like speeding or going through a red light or something of that sort, where they've got a camera set up at a road junction and they can either film you going through a red light, and irrespective of whether it was done by accident because you were a stranger in a strange place, perhaps driving at night in the rain when with lots of bright lights, in which case it's, you know, perhaps understandable that you might take a wrong turn, or, you know, or whether it's done deliberately by somebody who is just completely careless as to road conditions, it doesn't make any difference as far as they're concerned. They've got you on camera, and therefore, you know, you can expect to have one of these notices of intended prosecution. And the same goes for speeding. You know, police have gone through various phases with regard to the so-called safety camera partnerships, but everybody knows that these are just money-making ventures, and the proof of the fact that these are just money-making ventures are the fact that you will never see a policeman out standing by the roadside with a radar gun when it's snowing or when it's lashing down with rain or when it's dark or when visibility is poor. They don't go out on the occasions when speeding would be of maximum danger to the public. They only go out on days when it's nice and sunny, when there's good road holding, good grip on the roads, the roads are dry and firm and they've got good visibility, and it's daylight and the sun's shining, and they can see for miles, and they know that the drivers can see for miles as well. So they don't go out and speed gun when it's most dangerous to the public for people to speed. They go out and they speed gun when it's most likely that they'll catch the largest number of people and therefore increase the revenue for their particular police force. And this again eats into the respect that the public have for the police, and as I say, if current trends continue and the police force continues to diminish in terms of its operational capability because of the various factors that we've been talking about, then the respect that the public have for the police will continue to diminish as well.
Well, it's not, really it's not just the police, is it? I mean, it's the prisons as well. People are losing all respect for the prison officers. I mean, we've got all the awful things going on in the prisons at the moment. I mean, just this instance here where they're putting a man into a woman's prison because of political correctness when it was quite obvious what he was actually going to do. But it seems like this guy was like a real nasty piece of work as well. And former neighbours said he ruled their estate with fear, explaining that when an elderly man referred to White as he, White called the police to report it as a hate crime. So this was like a real politically correct person, but he's been charged with raping a child and raping a woman. Francis Crook, chief executive of the Howard League for Penal Reform, said there is currently a toxic political environment where some campaigners are pushing very hard on trans rights. She said there is emerging evidence that certain men are jumping on the trans bandwagon to access and harm very vulnerable women in prison. And this is not the first time that this has happened. They've put men in women's prisons before that have said that they're actually now females, and they've done exactly the same thing. And what they're talking, I don't think they're going to actually change this. I think they're still going to put men in these prisons, but I think what they're trying to do now is do away with women's prisons altogether. I've heard calls for that instead of actually having women's prisons, they're going to have women's refuges where they ask these women, whether they want help with their rent or whether they've got problems with debt or whether they've got bringing up their children. Certainly not actually any punishment involved there. Writing for The Times, columnist Janice Turner was outraged by the news of White's assaults. She said confining a rapist in a women's prison among vulnerable inmates, including rape victims, is like locking a fox in a hen house. According to Turner, the case illustrates a principle now hard baked into schools, prisons, and across the public sector, that women's physical safety is less important than gender expression. She said it might be time to acknowledge that the physical safety of women and the desire for trans prisoners to affirm their gender identity are irreconcilable. The national chair of the Prison Officers Association, Mark Fairhurst, said placing the known rapist among women prisoners was disgraceful and demanded an inquiry, and White has now been moved back to an all-male prison. Well, it's very good that they're actually pointing out this, that women's safety appears to have taken a back seat as far as gender identity is concerned. But it's not just with gender identity. I mean, women's safety has taken a back seat as far as all of these progressive ideologies are concerned. The very fact that the massive increase in rapes, the grooming gangs, I mean, nobody seems to be pointing out the fact that, surely our women, they should be coming first, not the Muslims, not the Muslims' feelings, or we can't afford to upset the Muslims, so we won't actually warn the girls at school to watch out for Pakistani grooming gangs, watch out for Muslims offering to buy them kebabs and buy them chips. They won't actually warn them about that. They would just say, it's all men. So it's not just these women prisons and gender identity. It's all around. And the people that you would expect to really be making a point about this would be the feminists. And of course, they're absolutely silent. There is some, contention between some feminists and, transsexuals. They're saying that transsexuals aren't actually real women, but none of them are speaking up about the fact that, girls in changing rooms and in the bathroom, what have you, these transsexuals are going in there and taking advantage of that. I mean, it's just said it here that there's evidence that this is happening more and more often, that people are now taking advantage of this gender identity thing that's being pushed on us all. And of course, this is something that we've been warning about as nationalists for years. I mean, we've been saying for years that if they start changing over bathrooms and saying that men can, transsexuals can use the women's bathroom, that's just opening it up for abuse. And there have
that sort of thing has started already. There have been a number of occasions where people have recently started complaining that in their schools or in their children's schools, that the toilets are being refurbished and then being represented as unisex toilets, where you go in there and there's just like a bank of cubicles that anybody of any sex can go into and use. And so there are going to be, you know, boys and girls both using the same using cubicles either side of each other, and so, you know, that's a recipe for a recipe for future problems, and there have been there's been a proliferation of these kind of open air toilets. I've noticed with certain people posting information about it in social media, where these like continental style urinals, just like a freestanding urinal with just a very small sort of privacy wall around it, but which effectively in town centres people are just urinating in full view of those people who are on the wrong side of the wall, effectively.
Yeah, there's no hygiene there either. You know, you can't wash your hands. Everything's gradually getting worse and worse. I mean, when you think of the immigrants that just crap on the streets, now people are being expected, it's quite normal to just go and have a wee in the middle of the street in one of these pop-up urinals and then go off to the supermarket, handle the food and the groceries, the fruit and vegetables and all the rest of it. You know, everything is just gradually getting ground down to a lower level of civilization than what we've ever had before. And I'm just thinking about these, you know, what you're saying there about in the schools where they've got these unisex toilets. But you think when they've got unisex changing rooms, I mean, when you're going through adolescence, you get quite embarrassed about your body. I know, girls particularly get embarrassed about their bodies, and they're going to be forced to share the same changing rooms as the boys just so that they don't upset the 0.000 whatever it is percent that might actually be a transsexual. And don't forget, these transsexuals themselves are deeply damaged people. That's the reason why they question their gender identity. They've got delusions. They've got mental problems. A lot of the time they end up trying to kill themselves, or they've been abused. And instead of trying to prevent the abuse, prevent the problems that lead to people being transsexual, we're trying to say, transsexualism is absolutely normal. It's perfectly normal as everything else. And you're a bigot. You're a hater, and you're a bigot for not wanting these transsexuals to be put in women's prisons. You're a bigot for not wanting people to just go into the opposite sex's toilets because they say they're a woman that day. And it just makes a mockery of all this legislation. And to think that Theresa May, because she's the one that's really pushing this, is saying that they no longer even need a doctor's note. They can just self-certify that they're actually changing sex. You know, I find that really horrific and really surprising that she would actually go that far. It's like they're all trying to outdo each other with their progressive ideals. And it's really harming children. We've got another report here. I guess we've just about got enough time for it. An urgent investigation has been launched into why soaring numbers of girls aged as young as 4 want to change gender, and whether social media is to blame. Well, I don't think social media is to blame. I think this idea that men have privilege, I think that's what's to blame. Equalities Minister Penny Mordaunt has ordered officials to discover the reasons why the number of girls being referred for transitioning treatment has increased by, wait for it, 4,415%.
Good God.
4,000%, yeah. Psychologists and behavioural experts will explore why, in the words of one source, some girls think modern life is easier to bear if they become boys. Official figures show the number of children referred for gender treatment, including hormone injections, has risen from 97 in 2009 to 2,519 in 2017. But by far the steepest rise has come among girls, up from 40 to 1,806. And a total of 45 of the children were aged 6 or under, with the youngest ones being just 4. Just think, and they're being given hormone injections, and they're being expected to know that they are actually the wrong sex in the wrong body at the age of four. Last night, a source in the Government Equalities Office, which handles policies on women, sexual orientation and transgender equality, said there has been a substantial increase in the number of individuals assigned female at birth being referred to the NHS. There is evidence that this trend is happening in other countries as well. Little is known, however, about why this is and what are the long-term impacts. They have no idea what the impacts are going to be of feeding a child the wrong hormones. Men need testosterone, women need estrogen. And it's very, very important. It's important for your blood, for your red blood cells, for the health of your heart, for your muscles, for your bones, let alone sexual characteristics. There are lots of other things that are associated with these hormones that are absolutely essential. And what they're doing is they're swapping the hormones around in these children. And it's worse than child abuse. And they're doing damage to their bodies that they have no idea what the long-term results of it is actually going to be. And they are thinking that this is wonderful. Is it social media that's causing it? No, it's not social media that's causing it. It's the promotion and the celebration of these people that are transsexuals. And I think the reason why there's been this drive in these girls wanting to become boys is because there's all this nonsense about the patriarchy and the glass ceiling for women, and women are being kept out of science purely because they're women. Do you know what I mean, Max? All this propaganda all the time that is claiming that men have it better than women. I think that's got something to do with it.
Yeah, I think that's I think you're absolutely right there. It's a shocking thing, really. I think what's been shown in a number of these cases is that a child has just made just a passing remark saying, "Oh, I wish I was a boy," because her brother, you know, was allowed to do something that she wasn't allowed to do, and that's then pretty much been taken that, oh, you know, she wants to change her gender, and people have not wanted to contradict that and say, well, don't be so silly, you know, you're a girl, which is what they would have said in days gone by or years gone by, and people won't say that sort of thing for fear of being accused of committing hate crime. And so what you have are all these people that previously would have been responsible for public health, who normally would have just told people to, you know, not be so silly and to think again. These people are just terrified of doing that. And so as soon as somebody says that they want to change their sex, well, then that everything is made available to them. And they're kind of rushed through without any kind of precautions being taken to make sure that you know, that there is some deep-seated problem or the other. And at the end of the day, you know, as you say, the number of people that are actually affected by this sort of thing are in genuine cases are absolutely minuscule, and yet our entire culture when it comes to sexual health is being corrupted in order to accommodate this fad for political correctness.
It's a tiny proportion of the population, and the kids themselves. I mean, I used to have friends that were tomboys, that were girls that used to be tomboys, and they all turned out to be absolutely perfectly fine. They didn't turn out to be dykes. They didn't turn out to be transsexuals. Just accepted that you had tomboys. But nowadays, that, you know, they will be encouraging it. I've got a final bit here. The Mail on Sunday disclosed last month that almost two-thirds of children and teenagers who say they want to change sex have been diagnosed with serious mental health disorders before expressing the desire to transition. That's what's at the root of this, serious mental health disorders. A total of 63% have had one or more diagnoses of a psychiatric disorder or neurodevelopmental disability before announcing they wanted to change gender. Almost half had self-harmed, and 50% had suffered a traumatic event in their lives, such as being bullied or suffering sexual abuse. The MOS has revealed the fears of a leading doctor that the health of hundreds of children is being put at risk by sex change drugs doled out on the NHS. Dr. Lucy Griffin, a consultant psychiatrist at Bristol Royal Infirmary, said she was extremely worried about the long-term effects the medication was having on adolescents. She warned that medicines being given to teens to help them change gender can render them infertile, cause osteoporosis, and result in sexual dysfunction. The medicines include puberty blocker drugs, which halve the onset of adulthood, and cross-sex hormones, which start the physical process of changing sex. Last year, 800 children in England who were unhappy being the sex they were born were given puberty-blocking injections, including some as young as 10 years old. The debate comes against the backdrop of a row between feminists and transgender activists over whether transgender women, who were born male, should be placed in the same category as biological females. This is horrific. I think a lot of it is probably being driven by single mothers doing this to their young boys, dressing them up as girls and you know, encouraging them to be like females. I remember a case a while back where there was a young boy that this had happened to, and the brave father had to really fight against all the political correctness to get his son back, because this crazy woman was dressing him up as a girl and telling everyone he was a transsexual when a little boy just wanted to go out and play football with his mates, and she was telling everyone he was a transsexual and a transgender. Because I don't think there are many fathers that are involved in this, that are very proud of their children wanting to change sex. Anyway, we've gone a little bit over time here, Max. I don't know if you want to add anything about this before we finish.
No, I can't think of anything off the top of my head that would make any great contribution. So thank you very much for the enjoyable conversation today.
Yeah, it's been a great podcast, I think. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back. We won't be back next Monday. We've got something else for you next Monday. We will be back the following Monday. Don't forget that we do require donations to keep the website going, and we do have a Bitcoin wallet at the bottom of every article. We'll see you in 2 weeks' time. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.
Alternative to the anti-white system on RadioArian.com.